What, how does the enlightened man recognize an ignorant person? Does an enlightened person recognize another one as ignorant and stupid? It's a very difficult thing even to comprehend, difficult factor even to comprehend. Because there is no enlightenment as long as there is an idea that this feeling that I am the body is the truth, or I am the personality is the truth. So long there is no enlightenment, there is no... And now if you are enlightened, which the Yoga Vasishtha compares to the state of deep sleep, the enlightened man lives as if in deep sleep. In deep sleep, you are not aware of yourself as the body and personality, and therefore you are not aware of the other as your body and personality either. So what? Now, where are we? And yet, if the enlightenment did not recognize another person as now. Now comes the difficulty. In quotes, needing instruction. Not because he is ignorant, but here is a person who needs instruction. They have all sorts of complicated theological explanations of the man who has reached enlightenment is aware that at a certain stage of one's development or evolution, there is an experienced ignorance and experienced sorrow. That is, now we are getting into slippery, very slippery ground. This is the orthodox view, but it is very slippery. That having walked this path from sorrow to non-sorrow, from sorrow to a state of enlightenment, the Buddha, he is able to recognize that this is the path and you are on that point where you are still suffering, but you are enlightened, but because you are not aware of your own enlightenment, all slippery. You recognize the difficulty there? All that is dangerous, I mean very risky. Among the two sections, the Hinayanis, or the what call themselves the Theravada, who adhere to the foundational tenets of the Buddha, which is that there is sorrow in the world, there is a cause why there is a sorrow, there is sorrow. There is an end to that sorrow, and there is a path to which leads you to the end, ending of that sorrow. They go on, I hate to use that word, brood, doctor, because to me, brooding means sitting on eggs, and which gives birth to something new. It's a creative activity. Brooding, if the English-speaking people will please forgive me, brooding is a creative activity. But we use it in the other sense. So, they keep on, what else would you say, chewing the cud, but then that's also a wonderful activity. The cow chews the cud and that's how it lives. So, this is a waste of time. Beating about the bush, perhaps. That's a better expression. they keep on beating about the bush sorrow, and the sorrow arises because of craving, and there is an end to that sorrow, and the ending of sorrow is along this path of right living. But one step beyond that, away from that, is a very interesting fact. Buddha emphasizes mindfulness, awareness. The moment you are aware that there is sorrow, if you are intelligent and if the intelligence is awake, there must also simultaneously arise the question, is that awareness also tainted by sorrow? Who is aware of this sorrow? Obviously, the awareness is not tainted by the sorrow, because if the awareness itself was sorrow, it wouldn't want to get rid of itself. It's absurd, logical absurdity. So it is obviously not sorrow, but becoming aware of sorrow, you don't want to get rid of that lovely rosy cheek, rose color. Why? That's part of you. But if somebody splashes some coloring material on your cheek, you'll want to wipe it off. Correct? Only that which is not yourself is rubbed off. So the very fact that you are aware of sorrow indicates that the awareness is not sorrow. So there's an easy way out. Instead of bothering about that which gives you pain or sorrow, or instead of pursuing or rejecting and so on, coming into any kind of relationship with that which you think is the cause of your sorrow, turn the attention within. That which is aware of this sorrow is not sorrow. Is not unhappy at all. And then happiness is gone. That is what Buddha also indicates by the four dhyanas that he describes. In the same way, if there is ignorance, if there is attachment, if there is a craving, if there is ego sense, and if one is aware that this ego sense arises only in a state of ignorance, that which is aware of this ego sense is not ego sense. When the attention is turned upon that, there is no more problem. And once you have reached that point, through the pursuit of awareness, that itself being enlightenment, how is it possible for you to see anyone else as being ignorant, anyone else as being bound? So Vasishtha says, what a mystery this is. Huh? I am bound without a rope. I am bound without a rope. But there is a sense, there is an experienced bondage. Huh? Yesterday's film demonstrated that, where they thrash the hay to get the grain out, and then a whole stack of hay. And what do? With that? You pull out a few strands of hay, twist it into a rope, and tie the hay with it. Who ties what? Hay ties hay. Hay ties hay. And then the roof is all one single thatch of hay, and this whole thing is bundle is thrown on top of that. Hay supporting hay, hay ties hay, and old hay eating new hay. It's a cow. The cow has been eating old hay before. The whole body is made of old hay. And that old hay is eating new hay.
Hay.
I don't know if you have... Pardon?
Hay, what a mystery.
Hay, what a mystery. If you have ever reflected on this, probably you would enjoy the joke. That which eats your lunch or your dinner is yesterday's lunch. After all, what happened? How did you get your teeth, your tongue, your gastrointestinal system and all the rest of it? They were all fashioned from previously eaten food. Previously eaten food demands more food and eats more food, fresh food, and thinks it's quite satisfied and gets hungry again. When this fun is understood, then the thing called bondage drops away. What happens to the others? What do you mean others? When you yourself recognize the ego to be a non-existent shadow, what are the others? The mind cannot understand this. The mind cannot accept it. The intellect is baffled and worried. If this investigation arises in the intellect or the heart of a person who has not undertaken this journey, inward journey, which is no path and which is no goal, and which doesn't exist. The journey itself, if there is no path and there is no goal, what is the journey? So if one has undertaken this so-called internal journey, then he recognizes that similarly everybody is probably somewhere along the line, and it is quite possible. Now comes another interesting facet. You may be Buddha, you may be an enlightened person, and you recognize that, even if you remember, that I thought I was bound, but suddenly I realized that there is no bondage, there has been no bondage, there is not the slightest possibility of a bondage. Then this girl comes and says, "Christ, yo, I feel terribly oppressed." What a marvelous thing. That which is ever free sheds tears and says, "I am bound." Lovely, my dear. What do you want to do? Nothing. Only if you also see the bondage as bondage, can you suggest a remedy. This is the problem of people like Ramana Maharshi, who have stumbled into the truth, as it were, into whose lap truth had been dropped. God-realization, self-realization had been dropped, and they have no idea what it's all about. When you go and complain, they say, "What are you complaining about?" That which is aware of the sorrow is not sorrow. That which is aware of the bondage is not bondage. The only thing that that person can do is, when you go to him with a complaint that my father or my mother or my friend or somebody else is causing me a lot of heartache and trouble, they might say, "No, is that experience within you or with outside? It is in you. The sorrow is in you, the grief is in you, the jealousy is in you, the unhappiness is in you. Look at it." That's all. That's all they can suggest. Because according to them, it does not exist. But you say it exists. That's the only difference. According to them, there is no sufferer independent of the thought of suffering. But you think that there is some suffering, and that suffering comes from somewhere else. This is the problem. They accept suffering as a sort of play. The same God, in theological terms, the same God who sits there enlightened, comes to him as the unenlightened, as the miserable, as the suffering, as the he who has gone beyond this ego constructed world is in a deep sleep state, though he doesn't sleep. So in his eyes, diversity does not exist. But in his inner vision, but his outer eyes do see diversity, but in and through the diversity he is able to see that it is the same lunch. One piece of lunch sitting here and the other pieces are spread out here, that's all. There's essentially no difference. Like, as in a dream. All the dream objects, all the dream persons, all the dream creatures are part of the dreamer's own consciousness, totally undifferent, non-different. But all these things, yeah, all these things seem to take place. And that is the play, that's the drama. All this drama happens why is this silly question? Why does Shakespeare write plays? Have anybody asked? Why did Shakespeare write any plays at all? Why? What do you mean why? He might have said that I like to write. Why does that girl dance? Well, I like to dance. What do you mean why? The very concept of play was brought in because there seems to be no purpose in all this. And if there is, we don't know. We have absolutely no idea. Because you bring in any argument to support that there must have been a purpose behind this creation, a counter-argument can be found very easily. It's often implied in the argument that you offer. I heard a very great religious man, with long face and long beard, and pontifically declared that God created the world for the redemption of human beings. He said, my God, the human being came on the sixth day, my friend. Right? We are asking, why did God create the world in the first place? Then he created man, he might have created all sorts of problems in order to bring about enlightenment. The only thing that he created after a man was, never mind. We won't go into it, sorry.
Swamiji, the teachings though in the Vasishtha and in all the other scriptures, the simple, I mean, just as you said, it's so simply to overcome this apparently experienced bondage, just to turn the attention within, which the words themselves seem so simple, but that which they indicate seems not
so simple. And that's the reason why they resort to so many analogies and examples and illustrations and stories and myths and legends and so on and so forth. And as the Vasishtha himself has said, if you don't understand it the first time, go into it the second time, third time, fourth time, fifth time. And perhaps when it happens, when the understanding arises, it is as if, my God, why didn't I see it before? Take for instance this haystack business. Why didn't I see it before? How could there be a bondage which is made of the same substance as that which is bound. Any sense in it? And that is absolutely true. It is your intelligence that tells you you are bound. And by what are you bound? By this intelligence. There is nothing else. How can intelligence bind itself? There, Vasishtha might say, why do you bother about how can intelligence, how did it come about, and which came first, hen or the egg, and that sort of thing. Instead, look at the whole phenomenon. Then you will appreciate that it is the intelligence alone that imagines it is bound. Why? No why. Why not? It's intelligent enough. Why should it not feel bound? And then the whole thing disappears. With that, there is a near impossible puzzle. And that is, your normal life goes on. And even when you sense this bondage, which would have driven you down the bend a few months ago, you recognize that bondage without panicking. This is another funny aspect. Whereas the old self thought that this bondage was real and therefore I am bound. I am bound is the reality. Now, after the understanding arises that that which is bound by itself. A rope made of hay binds a bundle of hay, which is then thrown onto the roof which is made of hay and eaten by past hay, turned into a cow. When this whole scheme becomes clear, then you do not rebel against this, you do not recognize it as bondage, you recognize it as play. No other word is satisfactory. No other word is satisfactory. Play, just play. If the mind begins to ask why, then look at anything, look at the television match, look at Melbourne races, anything you like. Look at the legal tomes. Why should it be like this and not like that? Who put these three miserable little sticks there and call it a wicket? It's not wicket at all. So, there is no why in all this. If you want to play a game, these are the rules. If you want to play, play. If you don't want to play, get out. But so much of money is lost. Come on, bring your money, let's see. Who considered this money? Somebody printed some paper with somebody's head there and somebody's tail there and all that. And then So, anyhow, we have given these things value and they have the value of Caesar's. Render unto Caesar what belongs to him. Okay, no problem. And then there is no panic, there is no difficulty there. And when someone else comes to you with a serious life and death problem, you are able to smile and say, okay, come on, sit down and see, let's see. First, knock off that idea that your pleasure comes from somebody and pain comes from somebody, unhappiness comes from somebody. The moment that idea goes, you are booked for enlightenment. Then you begin to investigate, or begin to wonder. Not many of you know Joanne here. Doctor knows this. Joanne, the girl who from America who is here, long ago, about 5 or 6, 7 or 8 years ago. I asked her one day. Huh?
10 or 11 years
ago.
Before we started the
1971 or 72. 72 probably. A lovely American. Richard, John, you know Joan Libo?
Joan Libo?
From Miami. Yeah, she was there in the camp. Yeah, no, not in California. In Montreal, Balmoral.
She's at NASA too,
so. She was in NASA, yes. Yes, she came to New Zealand also, yes, right. She came up with a remarkable, I mean, we had a sort of Zen dialogue in Miami, in NASA. She came up with the most beautiful discovery. She said that which thinks this is sorrow is the creator of that sorrow. Because when that thing was not there, there was no sorrow in sleep. So, it is the experience that is the problem. It is not the other person that's the problem. Okay, in your presence I experience happiness. In your presence I experience happiness. The experience being within me. So, if you are not there, I can, with the permission of the president and others, I can hallucinate. Why not? If I have decided my only in your presence I can be happy, I can hallucinate. Everybody is laughing. All of us do this. All of us. Whether or not you laugh at me, all of us do this. I may do it in my own way. What are these pictures except hallucination? Correct? And all of you have got some picture out there in your purse, I know. I don't want to examine, but I know. In your purse, you have got some picture or the other. Your husband, your wife, or your boyfriend, or girlfriend, your children. Why? Because looking at them, you feel close to them, and you feel happy. Even then, the experience of happiness arises in you. It's not in the picture. It is not in the other person. So, that which creates this experience, that which experiences this experience, is the experience itself. They are non-different. The hay and the rope. Ho-ho. That's funny. Right. Now you are awake. Go on. And one fringe benefit, what do they call it in bureaucratic terms? Perks. One of the perks of this discovery is that you are unlikely to be really bugged by unhappiness, sorrow. You may still experience sorrow, but you will at least, after a few minutes, you will begin to laugh, okay. And you are also unlikely to come into direct conflict with other people. Because the conflict with others arises only because you think that your sorrow comes from them. Or they don't respond to you. They don't appreciate you. They don't recognize your glory, or they come and tease you, or they come and want to make you unhappy, right? No, you just look at them, that's your problem. What must I do? The experience of unhappiness arises in me as long as I think I am unhappy. You are trying to do something, that's you, your problem. Oh, good. Carry on. Supposing you go on nagging me or teasing me or doing all sorts of funny things. I look at you and say, okay, good, good. The experience of sorrow arises in me because I create it. Not because you are teasing me. Nice, good. Have you finished? Go. Have you finished? You can go. That is the very beginning of the story of enlightenment. And once a person reaches beyond the ego, one step beyond that, then there is no more, no problem anymore. Then one sees that the entire universe is a play of the divine. Why is it a play? Because there seems to be no reason for its existence. Perhaps no one has so far really and satisfactorily explained why this Supreme God must have created this world. Because there is no explanation. If it has been created at all, it has been created full stop. Not because. Or, if it has been created without a because, it may be because that is the best way to teach us to live without a because. You remind yourself that God created all this world without a cause, and for entering into some kind of a relationship, pleasant relationship, I want to invent a cause. Yeah, rubbish. And when there is no cause, there is no expectation, and there is happiness, joy. But that's again the perks. It's not the real stuff. The real stuff is to understand and to realize immediately that if there is a creation, it's a game that God is playing with Himself. There used to be some such claims. What's called patience? Mm-hmm. Or monopoly sense? Mm-hmm. Something.
Patience, yeah.
One played with oneself. I think God must be very patient, so He has been playing it for a long time. He is playing it Himself, with Himself, and all are actors in this. He Himself comes as the good person, He Himself comes as the so-called bad person. This is the drama, this is the play. It is not as though that person is really vicious. He puts on the mask of, Halloween mask, of a wicked person. That person puts on another mask of a saint. There's nothing, no essential difference between the two. When this is realized, what happens is an enlightened life. This becomes real, not merely a sort of thought process or the end product of a thought. If this becomes clear, totally clear, as when you are on stage, you have your villain and you have your hero and you are your heroine. They may all be total strangers when they go home, or they may be brother and sister when they go home, villain and the hero. So, God Himself puts on all these appearances, and He Himself, for what? For some unknown reason, or there is no reason, becomes the hay. And part of the hay is pulled out and tied and fed to previous hay. digested hay. That is a state of enlightenment. Will such a person recognize unenlightened existence? No. Yes. No, in the sense that he is quite certain that the whole world, whole universe is enlightened. But yes, in the sense that there appears to be unenlightened beings, or there appears to be a sort of play in which some play the roles of unenlightened beings. That's God, of course. I mean, if you believe in God, it's God. All through. If you don't believe in God, it's the Buddha nature everywhere. Even the next step to me sounds a bit arrogant, that the Buddha nature is hidden, waiting to be roused, awakened by a master. Ah, no. That's commercial. Commercial interlude in an exalted TV film on Buddha. The Buddha says, oh, everybody is Buddha. There is a Buddha nature even in a dog. Full stop. Why add a rider to it, saying that the Buddha nature is hidden there and it is your business to bring it up and... Nonsense. It is there already. See it. See that it is there. As far as you are concerned, your problem is solved. Or there is no problem. If she comes to you with a problem, then see if you can divert that attention also upon itself. The problem folding upon itself is yoga. The problem folding upon itself is spiritual life. Not extending, folding upon itself. Whether it is a matter of happiness, unhappiness, sorrow, grief, pain, pleasure, enlightenment, non-enlightenment, fold the problem on itself and see what happens. There, you see, the creator of the problem is the creature. The creator of the problem is the creature. That the dreamer is non-different from the dream, and every one of the characters that play a part in the dream. That's it. You're free. And if this can be communicated to others, not when on your terms and when you want it, this is a danger. This is one, the mistake that we have all committed. Everybody has committed. This message cannot be communicated to a person on your terms, at your time. The time must come for that person, and the terms must be clear to that person, then your job is almost nothing. Not even as difficult as a doctor's job in bringing new babies into being. The time must come. Yes, doctor? You can induce by about a few weeks or so, but not totally. The time must come. And when the time comes, probably it will happen without anybody's help or assistance. Maybe a little assistance is necessary. But the time must come, and the terms also must arise in the other person, not in the enlightened one. To the enlightened one, there are no terms, there are no conditions. To the other person, the conditions must be clear, that I must stop blaming the world for my unhappiness. I must find this. And yet I am not able to. So, you go to another person, anybody else. And then it's quite easy, simple, to fold it on itself, to fold the attention upon itself, to fold the mind upon itself, to fold the ego upon itself. And there enlightenment is waiting. It's so easy.
Om Sato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityor Ma Amritam Gamaya Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.